Attorney General Eric Holder is sending what seems like a warning shot to Wall Street, saying there's no such thing as too big to jail. There are reports that the Justice Department is getting ready to bring criminal charges against two banks, BNP for violating U.S. sanctions against countries like Iran, and Credit Suisse for providing tax havens for Americans. And yesterday, Holder went on in a statement on the department's website to say some have used the phrase too big to fail, but that view is mistaken. But it was Eric Holder who helped create the phrase. In March of 2013, when asked why the Justice Department hadn't brought charges against the British bank HSBC for laundering money from drug cartels, Holder said in part, "I'm concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute. It'll have a negative impact on the economy." Well, recently, there's been a chorus of voices asking, why is it that no one has gone to jail for the Wall Street financial scandal? A lowly banker was profiled in the New York Times this past weekend, but he wasn't directly involved in creating or selling the toxic mortgages that caused the collapse. One of those voices being raised belongs to Matt Taibbi. Recently, we sat down with the author before a sold-out crowd at a Harvard Books event in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His new book is The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. He began covering the financial collapse for Rolling Stone in 2008 and realized no one was going to jail. He decided to find out who was.
It's really just a story about why some people go to jail and other people don't go to jail. And it turns out that it has a lot to do with unconscious, unseen psychological factors. We just think of certain kinds of offenders as being people who are appropriate for jail. And then there's increasingly this idea that people who work in these big, too big to fail companies, they're the kinds of people who pay fines and go to sleep in their own beds at night, and they're not the kinds of people we send to jail. And I think that's a very dangerous moment in our history.
You also remind us it wasn't always that way. Arthur Andersen
right.
was investigated under the Bush administration, a jury convicted. Right. 28,000 jobs were lost.
Right.
That was a chilling moment.
Sure, yeah, no, and but if you even go farther back than that, the SNL crisis, we had something on the order of 1,700 or 1,800 prosecutions after that crisis. We put 800 people in jail. The accounting scandals to which you refer, I mean, you know, Arthur Andersen was part of it, but we also pressed forward with cases against executives from Tyco, Adelphia, WorldCom, Enron. The difference between then and now is that we decided to skip that part and just take a check instead.
You traced it to a moment in time, a memo in 1999, I think, mm-hmm. from Eric Holder, now the Attorney General, but then in the Clinton administration, about collateral consequences.
Right. So Eric Holder back then, he was a little-known Justice Department lawyer, wrote this memo that's now known as the Holder Memo. It was actually a sort of get-tough-on-crime document, but at the bottom, there was this thing that he outlined called the Collateral Consequences Doctrine. And all it really meant was, if you're a prosecutor and you're going after a big company that employs a lot of people, and you're worried about innocent victims, whether that's shareholders or executives who weren't part of the wrongdoing, or even just members of the community where the company has its headquarters, you can consider other remedies like non-prosecution agreements, fines. And for years, this idea just sort of gathered dust because they left office. The Bush administration came in. They pressed forward with cases like Arthur Andersen. And then after Arthur Andersen, people dug up that idea because suddenly it was no longer politically popular to go after these big companies and risk losing all those jobs. And so now here we are in this new paradigm where the economy is dominated by these too-big-to-fail companies, where there really will be enormous consequences if we press forward criminally against the company, not against the individuals.
Well, this is what I never understood.
Mm-hmm.
Why would a whole company fall if a CEO went to jail?
It wouldn't. A couple of years ago, for example, we had a couple of very high-profile settlements involving a pair of banks. One was HSBC, which is Britain's largest bank. They were caught engaging in a whole smorgasbord of unethical activities, but including laundering over $800 million for a couple of drug cartels in Mexico and South America. And they paid a check, a $1.9 billion fine, but nobody got indicted, nobody went to jail. There's no reason why they couldn't have snatched up some individuals from those companies. I mean, if you're laundering money for drug traffickers, how is that going to imperil the world economy to arrest that person? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, you say that it's gotten to the point where we almost kind of envy the people who are so rich. And conversely, we've started to really hate the poor.
I'm actually old enough to have gone to college in the Soviet Union way back in 1990, and I remember one of the first things I learned was that there were two sets of rules, written rules, which didn't mean anything, and then there were the unwritten rules, which were the important ones. Some people get in trouble, and other people don't get in trouble. And I think I found the same kind of thing. A single mom on welfare, she gets caught up in a fraud case for some incredibly tiny amount of money, and she might lose her kids. I mean, there are all these draconian consequences for that person, and yet you look at somebody like Angela Mozilla, the head of Countrywide, who created more fraudulent loans than anybody in the history of the human race, and that person not only isn't indicted, but gets to walk away with most of his ill-gotten gains. And we would never think to take away that person's custody of that person's children.
Stay with your thoughts on the Wall Street titans. I mean, your disdain for them is just dripping.
Right.
Dick Fuld, you describe him as a cavern-eyed, hollow-cheeked bully, inability to blame anyone else for a problem, the kind of person who would fall drunk down a spiral staircase and then sue the architect for building blurry steps. Now, there's a bit of a fish in a barrel aspect to this.
Of course.
Is it a little bit too caricatured?
I feel like my writing makes up for maybe 1/1,000th of the behavior of networks like CNBC.
This past weekend, we sat down with journalist Matt Taibbi at a Harvard Books event in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Fans lined up as he signed books.
Excellent.
I love your book.
Damn.
And since the vampire squid analogy, I have looked to some of your work.
That's going
to
be on my gravestone.
Yes, I think it will.
Vampire giant squid was what Matt called the Wall Street firm Goldman Sachs in a piece for Rolling Stone. He recently left Rolling Stone to join journalist Glenn Greenwald of Edward Snowden fame in a new online venture. And his new book, The Divide, makes the case that there are two Americas, one in which Wall Street miscreants pay fines instead of doing time, another in which poor Americans go to jail. He takes on the Obama administration for its too-big-to-fail attitude toward banks, something Attorney General Eric Holder denied yesterday. He also takes on Bill Clinton for welfare reform, which Matt Taibbi says resulted in social workers becoming fraud investigators and the poor losing the party that once advocated for them. He says as prosecutions on Wall Street halted, the fight against petty crime ramped up, even though crime rates were dropping. And through programs like Stop and Frisk, police began trolling for arrestable subjects like commercial fishermen. Let's pick up there.
So this is a story that I found in cities all over America. It's this new statistics-based policing strategy, the sort of broken windows theory of policing. And the idea there was that if you arrest people for even very minor things like jumping a subway turnstile, they're going to be less likely to go out into the streets with an illegal weapon because they're going to be afraid of being arrested for something small. But what we found was that police started to get mission creep. They were now just sort of sweeping into neighborhoods willy-nilly. They're looking for drugs, guns, and warrants, and they start picking people up for anything and everything. Now, Stop and Frisk, you can just pick people up for no reason at all and force them to empty their pockets, which had an interesting consequence, skyrocketing marijuana arrests in New York, because marijuana possession had actually been decriminalized in the late 70s in New York, as long as it was concealed. But what Stop and Frisk did is it made you stop and then empty your pockets, and as soon as you're holding your joint out in the open, that now became a crime. And as late as 2012, we were having 50,000 marijuana or possession arrests a year in New York City for an offense that was technically not even against the law. Carrying an open container, riding the wrong way down a sidewalk with your bicycle. I had a person that I write about in this book who goes through this incredible odyssey because he's blocking pedestrian traffic.
That's Andrew Brown.
Yeah.
You tell a little of his story because at one point I'm reading and I'm thinking, why doesn't he just get up every morning and go arrest himself?
Right. Yeah.
Because he would just, no matter what he did, he'd get arrested.
Yeah. So he's a 35-year-old African-American bus driver. He'd been arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic, and like most white New Yorkers, I had no idea what that was. And I asked him to elaborate. He pulls out his summons, and sure enough, it's written on the summons. And he tells me the story about how he's coming home from work. He's in his tie. He's got his, you know, bus driver ID hanging around his neck. He stops in front of his own house at 1 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody else in the street. And the police press forward with this dumb charge because, as I would find out later, some police in some precincts have this mandate to empty a pad of summonses every month. So they gave him obstructing pedestrian traffic. And it took forever for this poor guy to get into court with the judge. And it wasn't until like 20 minutes later that they asked the policeman finally, was there anybody else on the street for you to obstruct? And the policeman sheepishly admits, no, it was all empty. And so they dismissed the case. But this turns out to be, as a city councilman in Baltimore, which also has the same kind of problem, described it, it's like an epidemic of false arrest.
Couple questions. Didn't the broken windows policy lower crime?
One could make the argument that it did, although, I mean, there were criminologists that I talked to who claimed that the drop in crime began before the implementation of these strategies. But even if it did, you know, the statistics show that only in about 2% of cases in stop and frisk did one of these stops result in them coming up with a gun or somebody who had a warrant on them. So 98% of the time, they're really basically hassling people for no reason. That can't be a good way to go about doing policing. And I talked to police officers who themselves were frustrated. We don't get to make good cases anymore because we're being forced to bring in 50 people a day for these, you know, riding the wrong way down a sidewalk. It's like an ongoing human rights crisis to me.
Well, look, a couple things are happening. Finally, there might be some indictments coming down in the financial collapse scandal.
Right.
We also read about the Obama administration. They want to comb through every prison system in the United States and find the people who really don't belong there.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. I mean, I would love nothing more than for them to do that and for like my book to suddenly become totally irrelevant. That would be awesome. And I think it's an idea that's gaining traction on both sides of the aisle. You'll hear libertarian politicians, Rand Pauls of the world, beginning to make this argument because from their point of view, it's a cost issue. Why are we putting all of these people in jail who are nonviolent drug offenders? It doesn't make any sense. But on the white collar side, when they actually go ahead and do it, that I think that'll be news.
There seems to be a moment in time. Why don't people care more?
Well, I think my theory about this is that the problem is too invisible to too many people. I was shocked to find out how much I didn't know. You know, I live in New York City. I should have known that there were 600,000 summonses being written every year for all these ridiculous offenses, that people were being rounded up for nonsense crimes and thrown willy-nilly into jail for nothing.
Or welfare recipients who have inspectors who come with a pencil and look through their underwear drawer.
Oh, God, that was an amazing one. This is this program in San Diego they have. They're called the P-100 program. One woman told me a story about an inspector who barges into her house, and just as you're describing, he reaches into her underwear drawer with a pencil end, and he holds up a pair of Victoria's Secret panties, accusingly, like, who are these for? This is meaningful not only because it's so violative, but it's also like if you're applying for welfare, if you're so desperate that you need to borrow money essentially from me, the taxpayer, then you shouldn't have a life. You know, I mean, that's part of the message of that whole image. And we only really use that logic for this kind of person, the person who's at the very bottom strata of society. Because as some people that I talked to pointed out, everybody to some degree or another takes money from the government, whether it's a mortgage interest deduction, farmers take subsidies, bankers take bailouts, but we're not going through their underwear drawers, you know. So, but I also think we can't really legislate a lot of the solutions to this whole problem. I mean, the undercurrent to all of this is a total lack of patriotism and social concern. And once upon a time, Wall Street people felt like they were connected to the rest of us. I think that social contract got broken. Some of these people just decided that it wasn't worth it anymore and that they were just going to try to get as much money as they could for themselves, however they could. I don't know how you force people to stop thinking that way.
Matt Taibbi, it's so great to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. That was so much fun.
Our conversation with Matt Taibbi, his book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. And again, there are reports that the Obama administration is considering criminally charging two banks, BNP Paribas for violating U.S. sanctions against countries like Iran, and Credit Suisse for providing tax havens for Americans. But neither is an American bank involved in the sale of faulty mortgages.